Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, this week, man, we get reads on a lot of economic data points. New home sales, durable goods, GDP, core PCE, FOMC minutes, personal income and spending. Say that five times fast. Not going to happen. What will it tell us about the economy, peak inflation, more? So many questions. So we're going to put a few of them to our next guest.
Peter Atwater is adjunct professor of economics at William & Mary. Peter joins us on the phone from Pennsylvania. You may recall that Peter is the one who came up with the idea of the K-shaped recovery, something that we've been talking about for the last 2 years. Peter, good to have you with us. How are you?
I'm doing well, Tim. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we love having you on because what you focus on is sentiment, the way that people are feeling, and you connect that to the market. So give us an idea, you know, on a day where it seems like we're coming back from touching a bear market in the S&P 500, what sentiment is like out there?
So depends on where you look. You know, within the economy, I'm very concerned about the sentiment of those at the very low end socioeconomically. They have been hit by a barrage of really difficult actions because of the inflation, whether it's food, energy, housing, child care. They're really facing enormous challenge in every direction they face. On the other hand, I look at the sentiment in the market, and I laugh with everyone looking for a bottom, because at lows in sentiment, nobody can anticipate there being a possible bottom. I feel like the investors today are like kids on a long vacation car ride, all going, "Are we there yet?" and that doesn't mark a market low.
You know, later on, we're going to play a clip of an interview our Bloomberg Surveillance and TV team did with Columbia University professor and Nobel Prize winning economist Joe Stiglitz. And he talked about, Peter, saying raising interest rates is not going to solve the problem inflation. It's not going to create more food. It's going to make it more difficult because you aren't able to be able to make the investment. Tim talks about this all the time. We all talk about this, that this whole idea of the Fed raising interest rates isn't going to fix supply chains, certainly not overnight. Maybe it reduces demand perhaps a little bit, but you know that's not going to fix all of our supply chain challenges and certainly not help those who are probably being hit the hardest like you talk about.
Yeah, and I worry that you know, the Fed's activity, particularly when it ripples through to things like used car loans and to, you know, home, you know, the cost of a mortgage, that's really setting a barrier for those at the low end.
So what's the Fed to do? And I know, you know, you're not advising the Fed right now, but, you know, the Fed Chief Jay Powell has talked about the blunt instruments that it has to tame inflation. It needs to tame inflation. Is it not doing it the right way?
So I have some sympathy for the folks at the Fed because, you know, their tools are not designed for this sort of a supply shock. But at the same time, I think we need to be careful in terms of overreacting to an overreaction in the first place. If you go back to March of 2020, we pushed all of the stimulus onto the economy, and folks were not paying attention to the likely bullwhip effect that then manifested. And so I feel like the Fed is constantly now chasing the last impactful moment in trying to respond to what is already a very impulsive consumer. And I think we're in this environment sentiment-wise where we tend to overreact. You know, there's not a lot of certainty that people feel. There's not a lot of control people feel. And so there's a high level of impulsivity. And I get concerned that the Fed is now trying to play in that same impulsive manner because we, the population, are being very impulsive at the same time.
That, I feel like, sums up so much of what's going on, Peter. I keep talking about, I don't know what the real economy is, to be quite honest, because we did have so much stimulus globally pumped into it, and now we're kind of trying to find our way back. And I feel like data points don't necessarily indicate that. One thing that really jumped out along those lines from the research you shared with us and our producer, Paul, you noted below the surface of today's record low unemployment rate is a crisis that has the potential to disrupt the broader economy. Just got about a minute left. So what do we need to kind of have on our radar along those lines?
So I think we need to be very aware of the stacked inequities that exist at the bottom, and that, you know, you have an environment where negative sentiment upon negative sentiment upon negative sentiment. And I think we need to be careful that we don't reach a tipping point, particularly because we have an economy today that is so dependent on those at the bottom because everything is being delivered to us. And that chain of individuals at the low end of the system are keeping those who are working from home afloat.
All right. Well, a good point, and wish we had more time. We will have you back very soon. Peter Atwater, he's adjunct professor of economics at William & Mary, on the phone from Pennsylvania. I have to tell you, one of the panels I did in Panama was on the global food crisis, and in some of the research I did, that it talked about rising food prices often lead to political instability, and so
right.
There are repercussions of this type of environment the longer it goes on.
Yeah, people talk about what happened back in the Middle East in the early 2010s.
The Arab Spring.
Exactly.
Exactly right. All right. So much to talk to, and we've got lots more to come. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic. We are Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Jamie Dimon talks. We all listen. And as Charlie mentioned, talking about some storm clouds, as you said, he's a meteorologist now, Tim.
Yeah, storm clouds over the U.S. economy, they may dissipate.
May. Dissipate. May.
That would be good.
Yes, indeed.
Let's bring in Sally Bakewell, finance team leader for Bloomberg News. Sally joins us via Zoom from New York City. Sally, good to have you with us. We got our live blog going right now about JP Morgan's Investor Day. Just give us the highlights of what's happened thus far.
First of all, I really like the idea of Jamie Dimon as a meteorologist.
If this whole banking thing doesn't work out for you, Jamie, we got something else.
You know where to go. Well, Dimon has been a big champion of the U.S. economy, and he struck that note again today. You know, it's robust because of all the stimulus that has been pumped into it. But of course, he nodded to this very unusual cocktail we have at the moment of surging inflation, quantitative tightening by the Fed. He also nodded to the volatile market and lots of liquidity out there. But overall, we got no sense that any recession is imminent. He has previously in recent weeks sort of made the prediction that there is a 30% or so chance of recession, much like the Goldman Sachs CEO, David Solomon, who made a similar forecast. But, you know, with Dimon's words today and with projections by the bank, we've got the kind of this relatively positive picture with, there's no real imminent recession on the horizon. We saw new higher guidance for net interest income, accelerating loan growth, strong credit quality. In fact, Diamond said that he'd never seen credit look so good. No particular changes in consumer behavior, and at least flat, if not up, deposits. So it's not a particularly negative, you know, there's not too many negatives to take away. I guess the ominous thing is, you know, it's hard, and as Diamond said, it's very hard to predict what any recession, if it did happen, would look like, because this cocktail is so unusual and sort of unprecedented.
I got to say, Sally, too, he said they may dissipate, meaning those storm clouds. Like, if he said, of course, folks, they're going to dissipate, just might take a little while. But he said they may dissipate. So I agree with you, right? It is hard to predict. And I think that's the dilemma that so many CEOs and leaders find themselves in. Having said that, wasn't part of the update about their growth and movement increasingly into the wealth management side of the business? And I feel like I want to bring that up because it plays to a very specific sector of our economy.
Yeah, they want to have 10% of wealth market share. They're hiring some 1,300 advisors as they double down in that area. So it's definitely a big focus for them. I mean, they gave a lot of updates on some of the, you know, the company's plans. They're expanding by product, they're expanding by country, they're entering 7 new markets. They've announced plans to introduce an interest-free pay-in-4 option for debit card customers, which is, you know, to compete with the likes of Klarna and Afterpay, you know, the buy now, pay later. They're investing in building out their international commercial bank. So they're expanding in a lot of places. And what they had to balance maybe today was the idea of assuaging investors who'd been slightly worried about the bank's higher expenses. It forecast an 8.6% increase in expenses versus the need to show where they're expanding and investing to capture, you know, hopefully something that feeds into the bottom line. But they seem to do that pretty well today because the shares were up at one point about 7.5% and lifted, as you mentioned at the beginning, lifted the whole of the sector.
Well, these expenses also have to do with the money that Jamie Dimon is paid specifically, because there was recently some pushback, right, against that in terms of shareholder support. I wonder if that's part of it, like Jamie coming out and saying, hey, here's what you're getting for the money.
I think he probably did feel that pressure. It was a really unusual rebuke for the CEO to have such little support for his executive pay package. He got about 30% support for his compensation, which did include some sort of special perks, special bonuses to entice him and other senior executives to stay on at the bank. And I think going into the Investor Day, that's why this one was particularly significant, not only because it was the first one since before COVID, but they had to kind of win back investors who had allowed the stock to tank over the past, well, so far this year, it was the worst performing among all Wall Street banks. So they did have to kind of win back some shareholders. But in terms of whether that those expenses were linked directly to his, you know, compensation package. Certainly within the corporate and investment bank, they have about 3.8 billion of expenses forecast for this year. I think some 3.1 billion goes towards technology. So that's the bulk of it is, you know, technology investment.
All right, Sally, got to run. Sally Bakewell, she is finance team leader here at Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
News.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, with everything going on in the world, I love when our Bloomberg team draws our attention to innovation going on around the world. And I definitely saw that last week in Panama, some of the unicorn startups in Latin America. Now it's Ashley Vance's turn. In a story in this week's new upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week out later on this week, Tim, he's introducing us to a company that discussed its business with the news media, Bloomberg, for the first time.
Yeah, I had never heard of it before reading this story. The company's called Meter. It's founded by two brothers, and it's got a new way to get workplaces online, as well as some noteworthy backers as well. Joining us now is Ashley Vance, features writer for Bloomberg Business Week. Ashley's also the author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Ashley joins us on the phone from Palo Alto, California. Joel Weber is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Joel, as Ashley writes, a couple of brothers, such as these could go off and they'd graduate college early. They could go off and they could basically do anything. They could go work at a crypto startup or start their own, you know, crypto company. They choose to solve a problem that many people would say, wait a second, that's not necessarily the, you know, for lack of a better term, sexy thing to be doing right now.
That's right. Although maybe starting another crypto company wouldn't be the right call right now either.
Good point.
What I liked about the story was just, you know, when we think about the way the world works, there are things that just the world seems to maybe have forgotten. And
have you tried turning off your router?
Bad Wi-Fi is one of them. And I've done that at home many times. I've turned it on, turned it off all during the pandemic. It worked sometimes. The other place that happens is in offices. And what makes these brothers interesting is this whole startup is about bringing better Wi-Fi to the office, which, hey, in these times of RTO, anything counts, right, Ashley? So where did this idea come from?
Yeah, well, these brothers are fascinating. I mean, to your point, they're Anil and Sunil Varansani are their names, and I mean, they're kind of throwbacks to me. They had this business in college installing networking equipment at offices, and they realized it was just too hard, and so they decided to go fix the problem, build all this new networking hardware and software themselves. But the big idea here is you're a company. You move into a new office space, you want to set up internet, it's still this kind of archaic process where you have to call about five different companies to make that happen. And so they want it to be more like setting up your telephone or your water in your office, where you essentially just kind of click a button or a button on a website and it appears.
And so, you know, it's one thing just for you and I to have this idea, and I like how you were like dating yourself there, Ashley. but they actually have an interesting Rolodex, and they were able to get some interesting backers. Who did they call, and who put money behind them?
Yeah, the backers is kind of like a who's who that you could imagine in Silicon Valley. You've got the Collison brothers who started Stripe, Diane Greene who started VMware, Egon Durban who runs Silver Lake, Sam Altman at OpenAI. I mean, the funny thing about this story is their list of investors is incredibly impressive, but this company's operated for about 6 years in almost complete secrecy. And so all these people somehow kept this a secret, and this is the first time, you know, the founders ever talked and anyone's written a single story about this company called Meter.
It's so interesting, Ashley, because these guys, you know, you could try to solve a problem from Silicon Valley or, you know, from Virginia or from New York City. But these guys actually moved to Shenzhen because the hardware in this, they really wanted to understand the hardware here. Talk about what they did in order to really make it so they understood the ins and outs of the business.
Yeah, I thought this was this is when I started to think they were the real deal. They had this previous networking business that they started in college, and they took all that money, and they just flew on a whim almost to Shenzhen and decided they were going to manufacture their own line of routers and switches and access points, but they had to talk their way into it. And so they lived in a hostel for 18 months and did manage to talk their way into a factory. They would sleep on the factory floor, and they had their beds. They had no beds even in their hostel. It was all full of their networking gear. And so these were two kids that, you know, they believed in themselves, and then they wanted to know every little piece of how this works. And so they funded, you know, before they got all these big-name backers, they funded all of that themselves and lived through it.
So I get it, and I could see, and as you report, that a lot of companies, they've already got a lot of clients out there, some larger ones, but is there success based on really lining up massive companies who already have invested so much in their own networks at this point?
They want to get there, but it's obviously a harder sell. You know, traditionally what you do is you're in a building, you've bought a ton of equipment, probably from Cisco. You probably have people on staff who manage all that stuff. You've invested millions of dollars to have the internet working at your office. And so to rip all of that out and bet on a startup is a little bit harder. But if you're a company, you could be a large company that's moving into a new office and you don't want to go through all that pain again. The mm-hmm. idea is you call Meter and they set everything up for you and they bill you per month. And so I think that's the easier sell right now is startup larger companies moving to a new spot.
And once you're in the cloud, everything goes great, right? Like what else could go wrong here though, Ashley?
I mean, they've got serious challenges ahead of them, which is like, you know, the network. If your Wi-Fi is not working at the office, you're going to hear about it. If there's some security disaster, you're gonna hear about that and possibly get egg on your face publicly. And so it's a young company. They have to prove that their networking gear is as good as they say it is. So this is going to be, it's going to be a long march. That said, they reminded me a lot of kind of like a young VMware. It's potentially this huge infrastructure play if they get it right. And so it's a big deal.
Does a company like this, Ashley, I don't want to put the cart too much before the horse, but it's got some big name backers and they're looking for an exit here. Is this the type of company that IPOs or gets acquired by an established player?
Like a Cisco?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this is a concern because Cisco through the years has been one of the most acquisitive companies ever.
Right.
And what generally happens is as soon as you're doing well in networking, Cisco buys you or Juniper buys you and there's a tendency for the technology to languish. Of course, these founders, as they always say, you know, promise me they're not going to do that. They're in this for the long haul. They're going to be the ones who stick it out. So we'll see. If history is our guide, Cisco tends to end up with this stuff. But these brothers seem quite determined to kind of make their name for themselves.
Well, definitely an interesting model. It makes sense, certainly, in today's environment. Ashley, thank you so much. Ashley Vance, features writer at Bloomberg Business Week, also author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. This story, by the way, in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, due out later this week. And, of course, our thanks to Joel Weber. He is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic. On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, this is going to be a tale of where reporting out this story is probably even more interesting than the story itself. Excuse me, everyone.
It's a market-moving story.
It's totally a market-moving story.
But the intrigue behind the scenes is pretty good, too.
So should we get to it?
Yeah, Leanna Baker is Deals Team Leader for Bloomberg News. She's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Leanna and her colleagues were busy yesterday breaking the news that Broadcom is said to be in talks to buy VMware. We do see Broadcom lower, VMware surging on this story. Good to have you with us. Can you take us through your weekend and just what happened when this news broke? Because you broke this story yesterday.
Sure. So on our team, we usually have someone on the weekend shift, but I took off this weekend because it was my bridal shower. I'm getting married in a month. Thank you.
Congratulations.
So thought the coast was clear, but I had my phone in my hand to take some photos. You know, I was with my future mother-in-law, and the call came in that this deal was in the works. So luckily, I cleaned up quickly, you know, sent people on their way. Luckily, things were dying down by then. And we started working the phones, and luckily around 7 o'clock, we did break the story that Broadcom was in talks to buy VMware.
A bridal shower to remember.
All right, above and beyond, Bloomberg owes you like a couple of wedding presents right there in that. I'm just
going
to...
maybe a comp day, too.
Yeah, or maybe like pay for the honeymoon or something. Unbelievable. All right, so just kidding. Well, maybe not. Let's get to the story, because this is massive. And what I like about these stories is that amid all this market volatility, companies are talking about or possibly doing mega deals.
So one thing that it does seem counterintuitive, why is big strategic M&A happening right now, especially in the tech sell-off? But if you look at Broadcom and VMware stocks, they've fallen in tandem. So as long as you are trading in the same direction as the partner in your deal, you could still do a deal. If they're trading in different directions, that would then be problematic. But we are going to see deals like this as things slow down.
It's not a distressed deal, though. It's not like the type of deal that we'd see in a bear market or a downturn where we see some high-flying stocks having fallen 70, 80, 90%. Like private equity coming in and swooping up some of those companies. It's totally different than that.
Totally. Broadcom, under its CEO, Hock Tan, they've been on the lookout for big acquisitions. They wanted to do something to really move the needle in software. They've done deals before, you know, $10 billion, $20 billion, but now at over $40 billion, this would be its largest to date in software. So they're just very deal hungry. VMware has been doing deals also for years since Dell bought EMC back in 2016. EMC had controlled VMware, and Michael Dell, the billionaire, is the top shareholder in VMware, so he's had his hands in this deal for a long time, and he's made a lot of money out of VMware already, but this will be sort of the final chapter should they end up selling.
Leanne, I know you're the deals person on here, so looking at it from that perspective, but I mean, a transaction, I mean, this Broadcom has been a pretty acquisitive company. Strategically, are people saying this makes sense?
Sure. So Broadcom does a lot of financial engineering, and they're almost like a publicly traded like tech private equity firm for all the deals they've done. But we are hearing that there are synergies here, and you know, some of Broadcom's customers could benefit from being upsold, you know, infrastructure software from VMware. So it's very complicated. It's in kind of the guts of what runs the internet is what these cloud companies are doing. But yeah, we're hearing that there are some cost cuts and synergies that could happen here.
Leanna, just the latest from you and Ed Hammond crossing just about a half hour ago. The deal is said to come as soon as this week. What's the latest there?
Sure. So when we reported it yesterday, we didn't know, you know, at what stage they were in, but now we could safely report that the deal could come as early as this week. There are some earnings that are planned, so we're keeping an eye on it. Although no deal is ever done until it's announced. Even then, as you could see with Elon Musk and Twitter, even if you announce a deal, it's not a done deal until it closes. So we'll be keeping an eye on it to see what happens.
Is there a chance that somebody else comes in?
So VMware has been publicly traded for a while, and you know, different companies could definitely swoop in. I wouldn't be surprised if they're looking at it right now. Always on the cusp of a sale to someone else, you get that final look. So we'll be chasing it. As of now, nothing to report.
What does the landscape look like right now? We've been talking a lot about, well, uncertainty and unease with the public markets and the economy. And typically during that time, you'd probably see a decline in deal activity. What are you hearing from your sources?
So we are seeing that general M&A activity is down 30% compared to last year, but last year was a blockbuster year, so that doesn't mean M&A is dead if you're down 30%. Tech deal making has been a bright spot, like you see with this deal today, and also private equity firms are licking their chops. They're looking at every software company under like $10 billion and thinking, I'm going to buy that. So we're going to be very busy trying to break the next deals in tech M&A.
And they've got a lot of dry powder, too.
They're sitting on mountains of it. It might be harder for them to exit some of their investments because the IPO market is totally dead. SPAC market has also died. But if they want to do deals, there's a lot of stocks that have sold off, as you guys, you know, report every day.
So the flow hasn't slowed down from the market instability that we saw, the volatility. I mean, pretty extreme last week. We certainly saw it in the first quarter. But I'm curious, people that you're talking to are saying, nope, we still see a pipeline.
People are busy, and private equity deals is on track to be like the second biggest year, I think, for private equity deal making, only surpassed by last year. So things are looking good, especially in that space.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, I hope you've warned like your team when you're getting married, when you're going on your honeymoon, so that like if there is a follow-up, if this isn't closed, you're off limits.
No phone in the hand.
Right. Well, you know, if I break this from the bridal shower, the wedding, you know, maybe I'll break a $100 billion deal.
Shh, don't say that. Leanna Baker, thank you so much. She's deals team leader at Bloomberg News, joining us here in our interactive broker studio. I do find it interesting. Even though deal flow is down, she's right. Like, we've had a record year last year, so it doesn't mean it's still not a busy year.
Shares of Broadcom, by the way, down about 3.5%.
All right. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg Radio.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow. Did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann. Let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, here we go, everyone. Just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Definitely risk on trade. But again, if you look at the year-to-date averages, we are still way, way off our highs, certainly of the trade.
Let's get into it with Michael Sheldon, Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer at Hightower RDM Financial Group. Michael joining us this afternoon on the phone from New York City. Michael, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you with us. So certainly a change in sentiment from what we saw at the end of last week with, we entered the bear market for the S&P 500, though we didn't close in it. What are you hearing right now, or what are you seeing right now when you look across the investment landscape?
Well, it's definitely a challenging environment right now. I think, it's been well documented that Fed policy, inflation, the events in China, the events in Russia, all of those are sort of conspiring to make it a very difficult market environment, one that's very different than last year and much different than the past 3 years. So it's going to be choppy, I think, over the next several months until we get more clarity on many of those issues. There's a lot of talk about, do we go into a recession? Do we not go into a recession? And obviously that may have the outcome, or the answer to that question may ultimately determine how much more downside there is. If you look back at all the recessions since World War II, for example, there have been 12 of them. On average, in a recession, equity markets decline a median of 24% and an average of 30%. So many parts of the market have already experienced a lot of pain, unfortunately, but depending on the direction of the economy, there unfortunately may be more downside before we ultimately get out of this. And there will be another bull market at some point, but we're keeping our we're keeping an eye on that.
In terms of inflation, do you think realistically we need to think about it being a much higher number until we work through some of these supply chain problems? And also, the global economy shifting away from fossil fuels, moving towards alternative energy. I mean, these are things that take time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think in terms of inflation, I think we're sort of at the peak pain sort of threshold right now. Jeremy Siegel from the Wharton School has famously talked about how the money supply has been a big factor in influencing inflation. So, for example, the money supply, the M2 money supply, which is basically broadly money in circulation, grew at about 5.4% in the decade or so leading up to 2020. But then due to COVID, the Federal Reserve basically pulled out all the stops and the money supply grew to over 27% on a year-over-year basis. And now, as it's been pulling back liquidity, the money supply is back under 10%. So there are some potential reasons to be more optimistic looking forward. And if you look at, for example, freight rates around the world or here in the U.S., you could look at some of the comments from the retailers that we heard from earlier this week where individuals are shopping for different items. And you could also look at five-year forward inflation indicators. Mm-hmm. So there are some signs that maybe on the margin inflation may be in the process of peaking, but it's hard to tell how quickly it will come down.
Having said that, Peter Atwater was on with us, Tim and myself, adjunct professor of economics over at William & Mary, and he said the Fed has to be careful about overreacting to an overreaction in the first place, meaning that, we had so much stimulus during the pandemic, and now the Fed has to be careful about, the impulsiveness of today's market and mistake of the Fed policy overreacting to what was an overreaction in terms of stimulus in the first place.
Well, that's a good point. So there are 5 rate meetings left in this year, and then the Fed funds rate right now is at 1%. So the expectation is that the Fed will raise rates by a half point at each of the next 2 meetings, which would bring the Fed funds rate to 2%, I believe, and then maybe do quarter point rate hikes into early next year. There are some Fed members who think we should be doing more than that, raising rates 0.75 point or 1%. I think Powell is in the camp that, you know, you want to see what the effect of current rate increases is over time and not overdo it, and then maybe reassess things as we go into the end of this year. So there's a wide range of opinions, but I'm in that same camp where you don't want to overdo it and maybe give things a little bit of time.
Michael, I want to go back to something that you said a couple of minutes ago. You said that we're starting to see signs of optimism, and you mentioned retail earnings last week, which were really brutal when it came to Walmart and to Target. Why do those results make you optimistic? Because I do agree that to a certain extent, the slowdown that we're seeing in the stock market and it's from some firms during earnings season is kind of what the Fed is going for.
Well, maybe I misspoke when I said optimism. Optimism in the sense that maybe inflation is starting to show that it may be in the early signs of peaking. And if you look at some of the earnings from the retailers last week, unfortunately, a couple of the retailers really saw their stocks decline significantly, but that's because consumers are shifting their buying patterns. So they're not buying the same things which they loaded up on during the shutdown of the economy. And retail sales are way above trend if you look at them on an historical basis. So as consumers start to pull back, that will mean less demand, and that will be, unfortunately, some of the retailers will be left with extra goods on their shelves, which will lead to lower prices and ultimately what the Fed wants in terms of reducing inflation over time.
So what do we do as investors right now, Michael?
Well, I think one of the most important things is you have to have a financial plan, and a financial plan will help you meet your long-term investment goals. So I think you want to be balanced in your approach. We've been adding to value versus growth. We're still overweight growth, and we are trying to take into consideration taxes. You want to have a little bit of weighting overseas, but it's too early to really get too excited about foreign markets. And you do want to be balanced. And unfortunately, markets may be volatile over the next several months, but having the right asset allocation will allow you to sleep at night to ride out the inevitable ups and downs that come with investing in these kinds of environments.
When do you see an opportunity to buy the S&P 500?
Well, it's not necessarily the S&P 500 itself. You want to look at different sectors of the market. We like healthcare, for example, and other parts of the market. You want to continue to have some exposure to technology because that's the growth part of your portfolio. You do generally want to be variation, and you want to be barbelled in your portfolio and not just load up on one particular sector going forward.
Hey, 30 seconds, Michael. Energy up 48% last week, if I'm looking at the major industry groups in the S&P 500. It's a top-performing group this year, again, up another, I think, 50% here. Would you be committing more money to energy?
This is one sector that's hard to love. And right now it's about 4% of the S&P 500, and some are talking about the fact it could go to 10, 15, 20% of the S&P 500. Unless something changes, it looks like energy should continue to outperform. It is hard to jump in after the massive run it's had.
It's amazing. Michael Sheldon over at Hightower RDM Financial, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99.
Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.